WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today is the first anniversary of the start of the war between Israel and Hezbollah. On today's Fresh Air, Timur Gakzel joins us from Beirut. He spent nearly 25 years with the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon, acting as spokesperson and political advisor. As we'll hear, things are so unstable and chaotic in Lebanon today, Gakzel had a hard time just getting to the BBC studio in Beirut for our interview. Also, the new film Talk to Me is based on the story of Petey Green, a Washington talk show host who got his start in prison as a DJ on the PA system. We'll talk with Dewey Hughes, the program director who gave Green his start, and Casey Lemons, the film's director. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today marks the first anniversary of the start of the war between Israel and Hezbollah. Parts of southern Lebanon remain in ruins, and the country is chaotic and unstable. Hezbollah claimed victory in the war and has been demanding more power in the government. Since December, Hezbollah supporters have been camped out near the prime minister's office in Beirut, calling for the government to step down. Meanwhile, the Lebanese military has been attacking radical Islamists in a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon. Joining us from the BBC studio in Beirut is Timur Gakzel. He got to know all the players in Lebanon during his nearly 25 years with UNIFIL, the UN peacekeeping force created by the UN to confirm Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon and restore peace and security. He served as UNIFIL's spokesperson and senior political advisor. He joined in 1979, the year after the peacekeeping force was created. Now he teaches at the American University of Beirut. Gakzel is from Turkey. Timur Gakzel, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, as an example of what life is like in Lebanon now, I'd like you to just describe where the BBC studio in Beirut is that you're speaking to us from and what it's like to get to where you are at that studio.
Well, this studio is in a building which houses many media organizations, and it is situated about 100 yards from the Prime Minister's office, which is in this beautiful old Ottoman building called the Grand Sarai or the Great Palace. And this, about 7 months ago, you might recall, when Hezbollah made this protest here against the government, and then they decided that they will sit in the government, around the government office, the Prime Minister's office. Well, that city became a tent city where hundreds, if not thousands of people, especially in the first months, spent the 24 hours here. A city was born here, made out of tents. Very quickly, it became fully equipped with washrooms, toilets, municipal services, etc. But of course, it is surrounded by the army and the police and rows of barbed wire and other obstacles. So if you come here now, it's quite a hassle to get here, actually, because you are constantly stopped and asked where you're going, your ID. You are always checked. And then finally, you find the building that we used to come and go with ease here hundreds of times in the past. And then I had to enter from the garage downstairs, be escorted from up the stairs to the lobby, three floors up, and then from there take the elevator to come to the BBC. And I have full admiration for these people who can cope with this in every day of their lives.
So this whole area is surrounded by like a tent city of people protesting the government and demanding that it leave.
Yes, definitely. And I didn't think, I believe that even Hezbollah, when they decided this very unique and unusual protest method, I'm sure they didn't think it will last this long. They probably thought that they will be able to get something from the government as a concession. But that concession did not come. And it did cause, I'm sure, a lot of soul searching in Hezbollah, why they are getting involved in this sort of street protests. Not all of them are very happy with this. They rather see themselves as a resistance movement and not as a street political group. So here we are, they are around. But what the result is, this is the downtown area, which was during the Civil War, the destroyed Green Line. It was totally rebuilt. It really became the center of Beirut, a heavily touristic area, restaurants, clubs, shopping. Now it's a deserted ghost town. There are only one or two restaurants and cafes open. Nobody. It's a big blow to the, definitely to Beirut economy.
From what I've been reading in American newspapers, it sounds like because Lebanon is in such chaos, that Lebanon is becoming a haven for radical Muslims leaving Iraq.
Not only leaving Iraq. I mean, Lebanon has. I mean, we had a civil war here because every other criminal or guys who are, you know, exiled from their countries or politicians or what have you ended up in Lebanon because it's a liberal country. More, I mean, in Arab terms, in Middle Eastern terms, it is some sort of a democracy, and so it has always been a heaven for people escaping from the tyranny of the Arab regimes around us. And it's also, it's very easy to enter Lebanon. There are no marked borders really between Syria and Lebanon. If you cannot come by the airport, you just walk across because there is no marked border. Now, there is a unique also element in Lebanon is that the presence of these Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. We have now 12 of these official camps, we call it, and there are about 20 or so unofficial Palestinian settlements inside Lebanon. Now, these official camps, which are administered by the United Nations Refugee Organization for the Palestinians, are off limits to Lebanese security. Lebanese police and the army cannot enter these places. So now, even if the people you are asking about, if he comes from Iraq, goes through Syria, enters Lebanon with no hassle, and the minute he finds himself in a Palestinian camp, he's home free. He's untouchable. Nobody can touch him. He could be the worst murderer in the world. So what happens in Lebanon, even the criminal, the ordinary crooks are ending up in Palestinian camps because they are free from the government, the police, the army, the whole lot.
With the 12 Palestinian refugee camps being havens for people who are the criminals or radicals, how is that affecting day-to-day life in Lebanon?
What's happening is that these people get organized in these camps. And in these camps, since the Palestinians in Lebanon have so minimal rights, they cannot work in 70 jobs. There's a list of that. They cannot improve their housing. They have to stay in this improvised, most miserable conditions. Their economic situation is very bad. And there is a huge number of young people just hanging about carrying a gun or looking for a job that will give them anything, which includes carrying a gun for anybody who offers the best price. And now you have an environment like this, and you have the criminal elements in those camps. They are finding ready recruits for whatever their cause is, be it be religious, political, or pure ordinary crime. And there is a pool of recruits, young people, who know at least how to carry a gun and shoot it, and who don't mind shooting it because they are bored, they are frustrated, and they have nothing to look to. These young Palestinians can cause serious, very serious security problems in this country because, as I said, nobody can go after them.
You know, right after the war between Israel and Hezbollah, Hezbollah was seen by many people in Lebanon and many people throughout the Arab world as being heroic because it stood up to Israel. And Hezbollah was seen as having kind of won the war. Now that parts of Lebanon are still in ruins, is Hezbollah still seen as heroic?
Not by the vast majority of the country, not as it was last year, as you explained. Look, you have to be in the Middle East to understand this mindset here, not only here, but as you said yourself, in other Arab countries. Since they have lost all the wars against the Israelis and have not really been standing up to them for any reason, and here comes this small guerrilla non-state organization, and they did stand up against the Israelis and caused a lot of problems for the Israelis, and that was seen as a major victory for most Arabs. I was in Beirut in those days. I spent that war here under Schengen. But even my Christian population neighbors here, they were all delighted with what Hezbollah did. But this ended very quickly with the end of the war. Then the extent of the damage Israel inflicted on the country, which is not only limited to the Shiite areas, but totally irrelevant places, way out of Shiite zones in Christian areas, Sunni areas, that was seen. And then the scope of the destruction in the south, in the Beirut southern suburbs. And when that became visible, then the people start saying, well, was it worth this price to engage in such a war?
Hezbollah had promised to rebuild homes that were destroyed and provide or help people find homes, you know, those people who lost their homes in the bombing. How much have they kept up their promise?
Well, they have paid money to tide the people over. They are not actually rebuilding anything. Reconstruction is something they cannot undertake financially. It's been done in the south by mostly by Arab countries and some international organizations. They have a huge project planned for the Beirut southern suburbs. They want to rebuild that whole area again. But that hasn't started because I think mainly because of financial problems. So they have not been yet able to deliver physically any sign of reconstruction. Financial essence, yes. But actually there is not much work done on the ground, and I think this is what is annoying the people.
Do you think that there's likely to be another war in the near future between Israel and Hezbollah?
Not in the near future. I don't think Hezbollah is now... Hezbollah cannot initiate a war against Israel. Israel is a formidable military state. And Hezbollah knows it also. I mean, they are not going to initiate anything against state of Israel. They are not going to take Israeli territory. Israel, I think, will come back. Israel has to settle the score. For most Israelis that I know, this is an unfinished war. But it's not going to be in the very near future. Israel army has seen its weaknesses in this last war. That's going to take some time. So we still have some time for any politicians or diplomat or something to end this conflict. What we are having now in Lebanon is a patchwork, a conflict management performed by the United Nations, admirably, yes. But it's conflict management. It's not a solution. And if you don't find a solution to this problem between these two countries, yes, that this war will recur again, but not very quickly, no.
You know, earlier in the interview, you were describing how difficult it was just to get to the BBC studio that you're speaking to us from in Beirut because of this, like, tense yeah. city of protesting people protesting the government, and that's kind of surrounding the area that the studio's in. Can you tell us a little bit more about how your daily life in Beirut has changed since a year ago at the start of the war between Israel and Hezbollah?
Our daily life in Beirut has changed mainly because of internal security incidents, you know, the bombings, the killings. And Beirut has become only now in the last 10 days or so, people started to come out of their houses. I mean, it was like last year's Israeli shelling time. Everybody stayed home. Everybody was afraid to go because of these bombings, assassinations that we suffered through here. But the net result of that has been a total security panic here. You cannot park in any of the streets. Anybody who is somebody or knows somebody in the security department makes his front of his apartment no parking zone. At night, if you are driving, we have these barriers that force us to drive through these very narrow openings. Beirut has become a very, very difficult city because when you drive through this and you see the police in every corner, the army in the next corner, one more checkpoint, one more barrier, again, no parking. This street is closed because somebody lives there. And life has become very, very difficult, and it's becoming very sort of annoying for the people also. And we are in a bad security hysteria here at the moment.
Do you go out very much in spite of
I do always, because that's the only way I learned to survive in Lebanon. If you confine yourself to indoors because of this, then you go, you lose your bearings. I mean, last year during the war, I insisted in Beirut, my favorite pubs and cafes in West Beirut to stay open. And I promised them bring business. Thanks to journalists who arrived in town, I kept my promise. This year also, I really prevailed upon some institutions that I know to stay open. I move around as much as I can. I have two children myself. But I do watch where they are going. I tell them to report to me where they are going and take my advice before they go to certain areas. Yes, we take those sort of measures, but if I cannot lock myself in. I can't survive. Otherwise, I can't survive here.
My guest is Timur Gaksel, the former spokesperson and political advisor for UNIFIL, the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon. He's speaking to us from the BBC studio in Beirut. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Timur Gaksel. He's a former spokesperson and former political advisor for UNIFIL, the peacekeeping force in Lebanon. He was with UNIFIL from 1979 to 2003, and he now teaches at the American University in Beirut and also consults on security. When you were working with the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon, and you started working with them in 1979. Were you there to kind of witness the very beginnings of Hezbollah?
Oh, yes. Hezbollah appeared in South Lebanon towards the end of 1983. Yes, I'm the witness of their birth, more than themselves. Most of them are so young, they don't remember those as I do. And they came from the north of Lebanon. They came from the Bekaa area. And they immediately declared the UNIFIL as a hostile force. So, and we start having clashes. They wouldn't talk to us because we are foreigners. So we went through a very difficult time with them until it took about 7-8 years before we could finally get to talk to each other and stop shooting at each other. So I lived through that, yes.
Were you involved in organizing some kind of open channel between the UN peacekeeping forces and Hezbollah?
Oh, yeah, I was the channel.
You were the channel. Okay.
The channel, yes.
So how did you open things up? Like, what did you do convince them?
You see, I'm Turkish, and I know how Turkish... Lebanon is very similar. It's been occupied, you know, it was a Turkish Ottoman colony for 400 years. So we have our traces all over the place. So I know how the villages operate. So I started to go to the village mosques and to village coffee shops where these people hang out. They knew me from television and newspapers. So, and being a Turk made me a bit more acceptable, I guess. So they slowly started to come to me, and I started explaining to them. I said, look, you guys are shooting at the UN. Why are you shooting at us? What is your, what do you want from the UN? We've been here all these years. We provide services. They said, well, it doesn't make sense. Why are these European guys are in Lebanon under fire? If they don't have an agenda or some interest, sinister motive, why are they here? They couldn't understand that there will be people risking their lives to keep the peace. It was just not understandable to them. So I kept persisting on that. It was a bit hairy at times. Not all of them liked it. So I kept on going and going. And for this very fine service I thought I was going, I got reprimanded by the UN because I was talking to a non-state actor and that we should not be giving them recognition, that sort of nonsense. You know, I said, well, who do you want me to talk to? These are the guys who are killing us. I mean, we were actually shooting each other. But I persisted, and the UN said, okay, you are on your own. If you get in trouble, we don't know you. If you succeed, we take your credit. I said, fine, that's okay, bureaucracy. And it went okay. It improved for a while. But the real change in our relations with Hezbollah to a more civilized level, although not very friendly, came after the election of Hassan Nasrallah as the Secretary General of Hezbollah in 1992. That made a big change. And after that, we had a more civilized dialogue.
What changed when Sheikh Nasrallah became the head of Hezbollah?
Syed Nasrallah is from the south, so he was an Amal member in the past, so he knew UNIFIL quite well. And we had soldiers in his home village, so, I mean, he knew UNIFIL. And he's a very pragmatic man, and when I went to him, I said, look, we cannot go on like this. He said, okay, we don't have to love each other. I said, fine, we don't agree on anything, but let's not at least talk about it. Why are we shooting? And he was out to change the image of Hezbollah anyway. So he immediately appointed senior liaison officers to UNIFIL. He says, these people are at your service. Anytime you have any problem with our guys in the south, call them and they will sort it out for you. And he says, and then at that time, we had an office in the town of Tyr. I said, well, if you have a problem with UNIFIL, you come to this office and leave your complaints there with my staff if I'm not there. So at least we started this a mechanism. And then I discovered, I didn't know him that well in those days, that when he said it, it's the law. I mean, his organization's behavior changed immediately after that. Okay, we occasionally had problems. Sometimes we had confrontations, but it was all at the civilized level.
Did your discussions with Sheikh Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, convince you that some kind of meaningful dialogue could be opened with him? That, or do you think that it would be kind of impossible for instance, Israel and Hezbollah to actually have some kind of negotiation?
At that level, I know one thing. I mean, he's a very pragmatic person, but I think his non-recognition of Israel is an ingrained mindset, which will be very, very difficult to change. Apart from that, I found him very practical, especially on the Lebanese internal political scene. When he took over, there were people in Hezbollah who were talking of an Islamic State of Lebanon, and he completely squashed all these talks. I mean, he actually emancipated the woman. He lifted all these Islamic strictures of wearing the veil and not going to the beach. And he basically said, leave the people be, and they will help us more, and they will join us more, which turned out to be correct. But on the more higher levels of policies, we really didn't discuss. But I mean, I know one thing. He doesn't recognize Israel. He's dead set against Israel because he sees Israel as intruding and taking over the Muslim lands. That is his conviction.
And you don't think that'll ever change?
That is very, very difficult to change. But on the pragmatic level, he will deal with them. He will exchange prisoners. He will make, through third parties, never face-to-face. He'll make deals. He will, for whatever he thinks is right for his community and his party, he will do those things. This is very pragmatic. And I also, I think most of my Israeli friends would agree, and Israelis take his word for it. That's amazing also. They said this man promises, he delivers. And so, but this is all on pragmatic basis. I don't think he can ever recognize the existence of Israel, no.
You know, six UN peacekeepers were killed in a car bombing very recently.
Yes.
And that was allegedly done by this new radical Islamic group that's based in a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon, the group Fatah al-Islam. So do you think the UN peacekeepers are trying to go through establishing some kind of contact with this new radical group in the same way that you tried to open up a dialogue with Hezbollah?
No, first of all, I don't think the main suspicion falls on Fatah al-Islam, but on Asbat al-Ansar, which is another Sunni fundamentalist group based in southern Saida. In the city of Saida, there is a huge Palestinian camp called Ayn al-Hilweh. This is a very fundamentalist group. Most of the suspicions fall on these people. And no, there has not been a UN effort by anyone to establish contact with these people, certainly not with Fatah al-Islam. What the UN is doing, as they always done, is to work with the Lebanese army and their intelligence setup, which also has very good relations with Hezbollah security. So, I don't think there is a, I don't think UNIFIL will come to this point of dealing with the minor or small groups that they cannot reach anyway. I don't think that is in the cards. But there is dialogue with Hezbollah through the Lebanese army. That is correct.
Timur Gaksel spent nearly 25 years as the spokesperson and political advisor for UNIFIL, the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon. He's speaking to us from the BBC studio in Beirut. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the independent film Sweet Land, starring Elizabeth Reaser and Tim Guinea, on DVD today. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most, gatesfoundation.org. And from The Dial Press, publisher of The Bestiary, a novel about a search for a book containing a list of animals excluded from Noah's Ark, by Nicholas Christopher. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
People are made of plastic.
The new film Talk to Me is based on the story of Petey Green, a Washington talk show host in the 60s and 70s, who got his start doing a show in prison. Coming up, we talk with Dewey Hughes, the program director who gave Green his start, and Casey Lemons, the director of the film. Also, more with Timur Gaksel.
What you get. It's what you get.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Timur Gokcel, who's joining us from the BBC studio in Beirut. For nearly 25 years, he worked with UNIFIL, the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon. He served as spokesperson and political advisor. He now teaches at the American University of Beirut. Today is the first anniversary of the start of the war between Israel and Hezbollah. You know, now that your work with the UN peacekeeping mission is over, why do you stay in Lebanon? You're of Turkish descent. You've lived in Lebanon since, 1979? The country has been in chaos for decades, and just as it was really turning around, the war between Israel and Hezbollah happened, and things just went back into chaos. So what keeps you in Lebanon?
I like the people. They are the most amazing people, really. I mean, I'm not saying a nation, because this is not a nation. You cannot have a nation like this. Nations don't behave this way. Everybody is on their own. At most, loyalty goes to their sectarian group. It's village-based, family-based, but they are gorgeous people, charming people, well-educated. They teach the whole Arab world what technology and high-tech is all about. It's an amazing group of people who live the life to their best. You should see it. I mean, we are in the middle of war here, and every day something, a new place is opening up where you can go and lounge about or eat or drink or what have you. And in my particular case, since I am sort of a local hero, public figure here, because I've been always on TV, newspapers, radios, mostly defending their cases and making a case that nobody else is making for them, it's amazing how much appreciation they show. I mean, I can barely sit in a coffee shop in Beirut and pay for my coffee. There's always somebody paying for it, and I don't know even who they are. That plays on my vanity, and I love it. I love the country. And it's not really a country. It's a piece of land, if you ask me. But, I mean, it's that kind of a piece of land. Also, I have my own kid going to university here. So I became a stakeholder, and I'm staying.
Explain to me how a place like Lebanon can have, like, you know, the nicest people in the world and also educated and everything, and at the same time, it's so factionalized, and there's so much fighting between the factions that's been going on for decades.
The thing is, this is the way Lebanon has been coming along. And in 1943, which was a French-mandated country, when the French gave their freedom, they made sure that the country was divided according to their own interests, probably, and made sure that the sectarian lines were drawn. So, I mean, the future of Lebanon was already decided in 1943 when French declared that this is a sectarian country and everything will be divided according to religions. So now, after that point on, the country became deeply entrenched in this system. It's a patronage system. It's a feudal system, actually. I have long given up in Lebanon that Lebanon is going to become a unified state and a model this or that. If anybody asks me now, I'm sure you're going to ask me the same thing. What next? What I tell them is, enjoy what you have. Don't shoot.
Do you think there's going to be a civil war in Lebanon?
No. There is no required essential militarization of the society at the moment. Yes, in Lebanon, never mind what you hear, everybody's lying about this when it comes to that. Everybody has a gun in Lebanon. Lebanon is a heavily armed country. First, it's a culture. Second, it's the remnant of the Civil War. And also here, in this part of the world, having a gun is equal to being a man. So we all have guns. Everybody has guns here. So don't worry about that. I mean, they're lying. Everybody has guns, not only one group.
Do you have a gun? Do you have a gun?
Oh, I'm a peaceful man. And yeah. Now, in Lebanon, the civil war, as I said, needs certain level of militarization of the groups, heavy financial outlays, and very deep, even deeper intrusion and commitment by outside sponsors who have to put in lots of money and all that. But now people have woken up in Lebanon. I mean, if you do that now, there's so much international interest and presence in Lebanon, you cannot do that secretly. There cannot be such a great big infusion of military hardware into the country without being noticed, first of all. Second, there is no Christian-Muslim conflict as it was in 1975. And one of the main causes of that war was the heavily, heavily armed Palestinian presence, which had turned the country upside down in terms of sectarian balance. That is not there anymore. So, I mean, first of all, I don't know who's going to fight each other in the civil war that everybody's telling me about. Yes, there will be security incidents. Yes, there are problems within the sectarian groups. But one hard fact of life is, in Lebanon today, to have a civil war, it has to include the Hezbollah. If they don't want a civil war, there will not be a civil war in Lebanon.
And you think they don't want it now?
No, I don't think so, because that will be very bad for their community. It will be the Shiite community, which has always been the marginalized, demonized, forgotten, neglected, deprived, or what have you, they have achieved a lot of things in Lebanese society. They have not gotten all day what they wanted, but they have made a big headway. So that community is improving in their medical and social and economic lives. So they are not going to risk that, first of all. Moreover, they prefer to be seen as an Arab nation and as an Arab unifier and not a sectarian group. Like, they don't like to be identified as Shiite versus the Sunnis, for example. Mm-hmm. And they also are perfectly aware, especially the current leadership of Hezbollah and Nasrallah and people around them, are aware that Lebanon, a smaller Lebanon cannot survive. No way. Economically, politically, militarily, it cannot survive. So they have to keep the state. And they know this. So I think they will stick with it till the end.
Our interview started with your description of how difficult it was to get to the BBC studio in Beirut, from which you're speaking to us now, because there's a tense city of people protesting the government. And this is a protest that's led by Hezbollah.
Right.
Okay, so what are your plans for getting back to your car and getting back to where you're going next?
Next, I'll go and ask my BBC colleagues outside whether I have to go through the same basement and down to the garage and out of the garage and say hello to the Lebanese army security, and then say hello to the Hezbollah guy there, also is watching, but they are very correct with me. They usually recognize me from TV. And then say hello to three other guys and walk down the hill where my car is in an underground garage, very civilized. But by the time I get there, I'll be saying hello to several armed people. And then finally, I'll make it. And then I deserve a drink after that.
Well, I hope you enjoy your drink after saying hello to several armed people. Timur Gakzel, thank you very, very much for talking
with us. My pleasure. My pleasure.
Timur Gakzel is the former spokesperson and political advisor for UNIFIL, the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon. He now teaches at the American University of Beirut. Coming up, the new film Talk to Me. It's based on the life of a Washington talk show host who got his start as a prison DJ. This is Fresh Air.
Guess what? I'm telling it. That's right, and I'ma keep on telling it. Some of it you're gonna like, some of it you ain't. If you got something to say, give me a call.
That's Don Cheadle as Petey Green in the new movie Talk to Me. It's based on the life of Petey Green, a streetwise Washington, D.C. radio talk show host in the 60s and 70s. He talked about race, politics, and whatever he thought was on his listeners' minds. Green got his start in prison as a DJ on the prison PA system. He was doing time for armed robbery. One of his fellow inmates was the brother of the program director at WOL, a black-oriented AM station in Washington. After Green got out of prison in 1965, he went to WOL and insisted that the program director, Dewey Hughes, put him on the air. Hughes saw potential in Green and decided to take a chance on him. Considering Green's prison record and his problems with alcohol, it was a big chance, but it paid off. Green was a success on WOL and later got his own TV show. The real Dewey Hughes was a consultant on the film, and he's my guest, along with the film's director, Casey Lemons. She also made the films Eve's Bayou and The Caveman's Valentine. Here's a scene from early in Talk to Me. Dewey Hughes, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, wants to put Green on the air. Since he knows he'll never get the owner's permission, he forces the issue by getting rid of the DJ who's supposed to be on the air, with Green poised to take his place. The angry owner is played by Martin Sheen.
I've been hoodwinked! You are out of your mind if you think I'm going to put this person on the air.
Sir, I know this is unorthodox.
Unorthodox? It's insane!
Sir, hear me out. This man has a unique voice. I just have a feeling.
I have much more than just a feeling.
Sir, we need to put somebody on the air in the next 2 minutes or we go black.
Black, black, black.
Frida, run after Jim. He might still be in the building.
Sir, we don't have time. You're just gonna have to trust me. One show. One shot.
Casey Lemons, Dewey Hughes, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to start by describing Petey Green's radio style. And Dewey, since you work with him and you heard him, why don't you give it a shot first?
Well, he had no style. That was his style. No one, not even Petey, knew what he was going to do when he opened the mic. And he carried his work with him. So if he was drunk the night before, he might open up talking about being drunk the night before. And it went from there. That was the beauty of being connected to someone like him.
So he would talk. He would talk to listeners also through the phone and play records too?
He did not play records. He would talk exclusively to listeners. And it was the first time that the black community in Washington, D.C. had an opportunity to call, whether their grammar was correct or not, and speak their mind. And if they wanted to talk about a neighbor being drunk and throwing their liquor bottles over in their yards, they would do that. And there was no place else for them to do publicly share that kind of information. Most people thought it was frivolous. Petey, he didn't feel that way. There was an absence of those voices on the airways, and that's what Petey was all about, really.
Dewey Hughes, you first heard Petey Green being a disc jockey in prison when you were visiting your brother there. And your brother,
well,
and go ahead.
Right. I did not hear him in the visiting room, but I heard about him all the time from my brother and other people. So I heard him in spirit. Visitors went to visit, the inmates, and I went to visit my brother. And before that, I knew the legend of Petey Green at Lorton. And the first time seeing Petey, I didn't see his face. I saw a man sitting there with some green alligator shoes on. And I nudged my brother and I said, "Is that guy an inmate?" And he said, "Yeah." And then he said, "Foo, that's Petey Green." I said, "How in the hell does somebody?" He says, "Petey Green." And that was my first sighting of Petey. But I'd heard about him, and he was a legend. And one day my brother said, "Petey's going to be getting out of jail, and would you help him get on the radio?" And I asked him, how long did Petey have? He said, 10 years. I said, "Yeah, well, I'll help him." Yeah. And next thing I knew, he was at the station, and that's how it began.
Yeah, he got out early and surprised
Real
you.
Early.
Casey, the way you depict it in your movie, Petey Green and Dewey Hughes kind of were two flip sides of a coin, and they kind of completed each other. Would you describe that kind of relationship, like how what they had in common and how they were different?
Well, I was very informed by a conversation that I had had with Dewey over lunch, and the way that he talked about Petey, and the words, the specific words that he used, and also his body language in talking about him. So in some ways, I had studied Dewey, and the things that he said to me, he said, for instance, he said, "We fell in love." And I thought that was a wonderful way of describing this friendship, and that they could work together all day and then go home and call each other. And also, just in knowing Dewey, who the first time I met him had on the most incredible suit I've ever seen. It's like, oh my God, a king has walked in. And then you talk to him for a while and you realize the stories when he gets into his brother's being in prison. And I was so moved by this contrast that's in him as a man and in the character. So really, that was the interesting thing, to have a character that appears to be one thing until you begin to scratch the surface, and then there's a complete other a man underneath. And Dewey said to me he didn't want to disappoint his mother and end up like his brothers that were incarcerated. And I thought it was very powerful. And so you have this man who's really self-made into an ideal of what a man is supposed to be in his eyes. And then you have Petey, who's Petey. Petey's just Petey. He is what he is. It's like, what you see is what you get. That's Petey.
How did you decide to cast Don Cheadle as Petey Green?
Well, because the character of Petey, he's a difficult character, you know? He can be abrasive. And so I knew you wanted an actor that was deep enough to pull off the outrageousness and yet was an actor that was so attractive that you naturally move towards them. And Cheadle has this quality that you are drawn to him. Even when, for instance, in Devil in the Blue Dress, he's playing a killer, mm-hmm. you still kind of love him, you know what I mean? And I thought that that was a really great quality for Petey Green to have. And I knew Don not very well, but I knew him well enough to know that he was funny and just tremendously talented. And so I thought he'd be a great choice.
How did you go about dressing him?
Well, it's funny. We went through a lot of magazines. Gersha Phillips, the costume designer, who I think is just extraordinary, she and I would go through tons of old Ebony magazines. It's really funny because one thing you realize is that you can't go too far. I mean, it's amazing what people actually wore, you know. And, you know, these models with a very serious expression on their face, you know, while they're wearing mesh underwear, you know. So we really got a lot of it from magazines. And then a huge amount of it was actually vintage. Some of it she created, but very much based on authentic, you know, outrageous fashions at the time. And also we had some photographs of Petey. And imitated some of the clothes that we saw him actually wear in photographs.
In Talk to Me, Casey Lemons, you portray what happens in Washington, D.C. right after Martin Luther King is assassinated, and there's rioting and looting in the streets. Parts of the city are burning down. And in the movie, the Dewey Hughes character asked Petey Green to, like, you know, go on the air and calm things down. I think it's like your boss who asked Petey Green to do that. Could you share your memories of what Petey Green did on the air right after King's assassination?
Well, I mean, he did exactly what Casey shared with us in the movie. It was brilliant. He connected with the community. He reminded them that Dr. King would not be a happy man right now. And that resonated deep and wide. And she depicted that brilliantly.
And then the next night there was a James Brown concert in Washington, and Petey Green introduced it in the movie. He shows up late, he's drunk. Do we use, did it happen that way?
Does it matter? James Brown came to D.C., gave a concert, and me and Petey, by the request of the mayor and the council members, got James Brown to come from Boston to Washington, and that's what happened. And the only thing he wanted was to go up on Capitol Hill and have his words in the Congressional Record, and that's exactly what happened. So Casey put a creative touch to it, and it's brilliant.
Now, in the movie, Dewey Hughes, you're portrayed as having learned about fine suits and standard English from modeling yourself on Johnny Carson while watching The Tonight Show. Did you watch The Tonight Show and model yourself on Carson?
Every night. I never missed a show. My sister, my baby sister, would always wake me up to watch Johnny Carson.
So what did he mean to you?
Everything. I thought I could be him. But I knew because of the color of my skin, I'd never get a shot. But so I live vicariously through Johnny Carson. So when I got an opportunity to have someone that maybe I could interest Johnny Carson, it was Petey Green, I used it. It took me 3 years to convince them to give Petey a shot.
And what happened that night?
Well, Petey got drunk, and he sabotaged it. Petey used being drunk not to do the show. He had no intentions of doing the show. I mean, we'd been there before, but I didn't think he was going to blow Johnny Carson. It was like, you know, the standoff. But he always sabotaged the real good stuff because D.C. was his base. He didn't want outside of D.C. All of that was my dream. Mm-hmm. And we were very clear on that, you know. So he went along when I was hoping that maybe he would go out on Johnny Carson and just do his Petey Green thing and impress the audience and become a hero across the country. But he didn't want that.
My guests are Casey Lemons, the director of the new film Talk to Me, and Dewey Hughes, who's played in the film by Chiwetel Ejiofor. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the new film Talk to Me, based on the life of Washington, D.C. talk show host Petey Green, who got his start as a DJ in prison. My guests are Dewey Hughes, the program director who put Green on the air, and Casey Lemons, the director of Talk to Me. I asked Casey Lemons about her connection to the story. Now, the period that the movie is set in, late 60s, early 70s, is a period in which you were basically a child. You kind of missed out on the culture and politics of the period. What do you find most interesting about it? Because you had to immerse yourself in it to actually make the film.
Well, yeah, I immersed myself in it to the point where when we would go on the street and people were, walking around in 2006, they looked weird to me. I mean, we were living in the late 60s the whole time we were making the movie. I had one incredible memory. I had a memory of my mother screaming. And a sound I've never heard before since came out of her. And she kept screaming. She kept screaming. And I went into the other room, and she was rocking back and forth and keening. I mean, it was really, as a very young child, completely terrifying to hear your mother in this state. And she said, I thought she said, the king is dead. And I said, what king? And so, too young to know really who Martin Luther King was, I will never forget the sound that my mother made. And so, in some ways, that was one of my entry points into the story and into the period. You know, when I would do research on the King assassination, one of the things that struck me was that people dropped dead on the spot. Heart attacks, aneurysms, you know, people dropped dead on the spot, fell to their knees and screaming, you know, God, why not me? And I thought, wow, this is incredible. When we really look back at this time, to think that of the things that really happened in this country fairly recently and what we've been through. I mean, we're so in some ways isolated from the trauma and of that time. You know, it was a very, very violent and interesting time, and yet a time full of possibility. And so there's something that I wanted to bring home to an audience that might not have experienced it. I wanted them to feel like they were there.
Where were you when King was assassinated?
I was in Boston. And, you know, I just remember my mom screaming. It was interesting, actually. It's an even longer story. My sister, my older sister, decided we would go to the movies. And I don't know if in my mind this was related to directly right after words. Maybe my mother sent us to the movies. So she could kind of grieve alone. But we went to the movies, and the subway was stopped in the middle of a tunnel. No, I guess we pulled into a station, but it wasn't the station that we were supposed to get off at, and they made everyone get off at the train. And it was lines of police, and they looked to me like the army. Anyway, the Boston riots had broken out. Rioting had broken out. And so I was separated from my mother. Of course, this was before, way before cell phones, right? So my sister and I, who were children, were trapped in Harvard Square. My mother, finding out about this, came to look for us. And we didn't find her for a day.
Wow.
Hippies took us home. You know, I can remember the beaded curtain in this girl's house. And in retrospect, she must have been a very young woman, took us in. But I was really young, and it was an adventure to me. So I actually had a direct experience, even though I was very young.
Wow!
What a frightening series of events that whole thing was.
Yeah. It was a story that I told every single person involved in the movie. Talked through it with the actors and the crew, because you know we were shooting in Canada. And not even all of our actors were African-American. We had a British-Nigerian and Caribbean-Canadians. And so just to get them into a time and place where we were going to recreate that moment and what that experience felt like, I told everybody my story.
What do you remember of the funeral for Petey Green in, was it 1982? He died of cancer at the age of 53.
I didn't come to the funeral.
You
they wanted
at the
me
funeral?
To come and speak. They wanted me to come and speak, but I was afraid that if I'd gotten up behind the podium, I would have cursed a lot of people in the audience out. who were there crying about Petey, and they didn't love Petey at all. So I passed on the funeral.
In what sense did you think that they were hypocritical?
I knew they were hypocritical. They didn't like Petey. They used to tell me they didn't like him. They used to tell me what it, ask me why I put him on the air. I mean, council members, congressmen, teachers, principals, policemen, government workers, what fathers were, who you know, had kids and stuff. They thought he was an embarrassment.
What were their objections?
It was at a time when blacks were coming into their suits and ties and their upward mobility. The poverty program was kicking and stuff. And everybody was trying to go establishment. Petey was anti-establishment. I mean, he didn't sound like anybody else. He didn't think like anybody else. And everybody felt, especially a lot of the blacks, felt that he was an embarrassment. So, you know, they should have somebody who wasn't an ex-con on the air, somebody who, you know, graduated. All of those points were good, but I had those people on the air, too. So it wasn't like Petey was the only one.
Well, Casey Lemons, Dewey Hughes, thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Casey Lemons directed the new film Talk to Me. Dewey Hughes is played in the film by Chiwetel Ejiofor. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chilog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
This is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing, nothing without a woman or a girl.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Ricky Gervais. Season 2 of his HBO series Extras just came out on DVD. Gervais also co-created the British TV series The Office, which the NBC series is based on. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.